Eight Nights, copyright 2013 by John Speed. Night 1. Nezgadol Hayasham. A great miracle happened there. We've lit the first candle of Hanukkah, and I like the tradition of sitting beside the flame and watching the candle burn down, and I like to pass the time by telling my story. My story is the story of Hanukkah. Hanukkah means dedication, and the story is of the great miracle that happened when the temple in Jerusalem was defiled, restored, and rededicated in 165 BCE. The story of Hanukkah is a big-ass story. It takes me 8 nights to tell it. It's tough to squeeze everything in. It's really a big-ass story. The story is the greatest story I know, and the great miracle we celebrate when we light the lights of Hanukkah is the greatest miracle the world has known. When I finally understood the great miracle, I wept. Ever since I understood it, even though I'm not a Jew or even a Christian for that matter, now every year, I light the lights of Hanukkah and I sing the blessings, and almost every night I weep. Because when you know the story and understand the miracle, it's such a joyous moment you almost have to weep. And now I tell the story to anyone who will listen. If I tell it right, sometimes I do. They weep too. I don't know if you are a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew, and I don't care, because whichever you are, we worship the same one Lord of heaven. We're kind of a family. We're children of that same Father. And the great story of Hanukkah is the miracle of how our family came to be. This is what the Jews of Israel understood. This is why they created this celebration almost 2,200 years ago, the only celebration of its kind. 8 whole days of remembrance. 8 whole days. Now, all the other celebrations of the Jews had been set out by the Lord with dire consequences that the Jews failed to follow through. The Lord of the Jews was big on dire consequences, but Hanukkah was different. The Jews themselves created Hanukkah. So they faced no dire consequences for not observing it. They observed it because they decided to, because they wanted to. Not because they were scared not to. The Jews themselves decided that the great miracle was of such importance that they wanted always to remember. They decided on their own, forever, to dedicate 8 entire days of every year to remembering. They swore of their own free will that they would forever gather their families together and forever sing blessings and forever recall that moment when the world changed for them. In fact, for everybody. They lit lights for 8 nights, outdoors or in windows, very visibly, so everyone could see. Everyone should see. Everyone should know. Because this miracle was not just about Jews. It was about everyone. The Jews created this celebration and this method because they wanted everyone to know about the miracle. They promised to keep this celebration as important as their most sacred ancient rituals, and they have kept that promise. For 2,200 years, they have kept that promise to this day. It's because of that faithfulness to that promise that I've come to know about the great miracle, whose wonder touches my heart, and I bow to them in gratitude. Thank you, faithful Jews. Now, you may have heard Hanukkah called the miracle of the lights, or the miracle of the oil, or something, but this is because over the course of time, people have gotten a little confused. When the great miracle occurred, it arrived with a miraculous sign. A bottle of consecrated oil that should have burned for a single day burned for 8 days. But come on, you call that a miracle? It's certainly not worth spending 8 full days remembering. In the Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, there's a ton of far more impressive miracles, and they don't get celebrated at all. There's men raised from the dead, there's hundreds fed with a single loaf of bread, there's men living unburned in a furnace, there's the sun going backwards, water flowing from a rock, and these are some big honking miracles, but the Jews didn't feel like any of them rated even a single day celebration. But Hanukkah has been celebrated not for one day, but for 8 full days for 2,200 years. The Jews passed the lights of Hanukkah from hand to hand, thousands of pairs of hands passing those lights to us. Do you really think a bottle of miracle oil merits such faithfulness? Only a great miracle would merit it. What seems to me to be the greatest of miracles. At some point over the last 2,200 years, the great miracle, sadly, has come to be confused with that miraculous sign, the oil, which is a shame, because when you hear the story, you won't confuse the miracle and the sign. You'll understand the miracle, and you'll understand why I light the Hanukkah lights. And maybe you will light the lights with me and weep. Now, how odd is it that it's me telling you this story and weeping? I'm not a Jew. I'm not a Christian. And yet here I am, tears in my eyes, right now, the one telling you this story. Why me? Why isn't a Jew telling you this, or a Christian? Or, well, Jews don't know it. I'm sorry, Jews, but you don't really know it. The story of Hanukkah is told in a couple of Bible books, Maccabees 1 and 2, and neither of these books are in the Jewish Bible. The canon of the Jewish Bible got frozen a few years before those books were written. And the only place you can find those two books now is in Catholic Bibles. In the Catholic Bible, those two books have been squeezed between the Old Testament and the New Testament, along with five other books that got written between the first Hanukkah and the birth of Jesus. So if you're a Jew and you want to read the story of Hanukkah and the rededication of the temple and the Maccabees, the basis for the most important celebration in Judaism, that's where you need to find a Catholic Bible. And I personally guarantee that no Jew you know has ever read either of those books. No Jews have them in their libraries, except maybe a few rabbis, and not many of those. And I guarantee no Christian has ever read them either. Nobody knows this story. And anybody who starts looking into it, frankly, gets bewildered really fast. His or her mind starts doing pinwheels. People today just don't know the background for it anymore. When it comes to Old Testament history, people these days, if you don't mind my saying, are pretty ignorant. You see, the people who wrote those books and the persons that would read them were learned men. They knew the background, not just the history of the Old Testament, but the history of the Greeks and the Egyptians, and the Babylonians and the Persians. They knew about Alexander the Great and the division of the world and the four kingdoms and the rise and fall of the kings of Judah and the Solomon's temple. They knew about Shekinah, how the fire of the Lord fell from the sky and walked across the temple. They knew all about the lost Ark of the Covenant and the column of smoke by day and the column of fire by night that rose out of the ark and how it led the Exodus Jews of the wilderness. And they knew about the mercy seat and the apparition of the face of the Lord and the high priests and the goat sacrifice made every year to the demon Azazel who lived in the desert, and about the blood of the red heifer, and about the tumors made of solid gold. They knew all that. And if you knew that, when you heard even the bare bones of this story, you would get it. And for hundreds of years, for hundreds of generations, when the Jews passed along the story, they also tacitly passed along the background, and everyone got it. The writers of the Maccabees books, where the story is told, they knew the background, and they knew that everyone who read their words knew the background, so they never bothered to make a big deal about explaining it. But if you don't understand the background, the story is pretty skimpy. Now, it used to be that the only schools were yeshivas, and the only books were the Tanakh, the Jewish Old Testament, or the Talmud, but suddenly along comes Bronx Science High School and The Catcher in the Rye, and suddenly the background just can't compete. The background begins to fade. And as the background begins to fade, instead of getting it, everybody forgets it. And if you don't know the background, you don't get the miracle. All you know is the sign, the slow-burning oil. And if you don't get the great miracle that makes your heart crack open, if you don't know it, if all you know about it is the sign, it's no wonder nobody anymore gives a great big shit about Hanukkah. It's no wonder that nobody can figure out why the Jews made it the most important celebration of the year. As the background, the oral tradition, has faded, it's gotten to the point that even Jews don't seem to really care about Hanukkah anymore. Most rabbis, if you press them about Hanukkah, about why it's celebrated for eight nights, about why it's important in the Jewish calendar. If you press them, they'll just frown a little. They'll tell you Hanukkah isn't really mentioned in the Bible. It's not really an official celebration. If you really ask them why it's been so consistently, faithfully, enduringly remembered, all you'll get is probably the palms up frown shrug. Hanukkah has come to be the red-haired stepson of Jewish religious holiday. It's a kind of pathetic Christmas wannabe, something for the kiddies. Here comes Hanukkah Harry. One of the worst days of my life was when I Googled least important Jewish holiday and Hanukkah came up as the first 10 hits. But the great ancient book of Jewish law and tradition, the Talmud, says that kindling the lights of Hanukkah takes precedence over reciting Kiddush with wine on Shabbat. It says, even if one is so poor that he has nothing to eat except what he takes from charity, he should borrow money or sell his own clothing in order to buy oil and candles to light the Hanukkah lights. If you bother to look into it further, the Talmud explains why. And that's what I mean to tell you, why. Why Hanukkah is for grown-ups, not for children. Why Hanukkah should be of central importance to Muslims and Christians as well as Jews. Why all of them, all of us, should celebrate the great miracle. Why we all share this story. And so it's come to this. Now you have this non-Jew, non-Christian, non-credentialed, sinful, unworthy man telling you the story. I'm sorry it's me doing it. I really am. But I know the background of the great miracle, and hardly anybody else these days seems to know it. I'm certain that if the miracle could have found anybody else, anybody who knew the background and knew how to tell it, there'd be a different storyteller. With religious stories, there's always an agenda, but I'm telling you up front, I have no agenda. I'm not a rabbi or a minister or an imam. I don't care what you believe. I'm not out to change you. I'm not out to change your mind, except that the miracle of Hanukkah is a great gift, one that anyone can reach out and take. And it may be when you hear about it that you'll want to take it for your own, just as I did. But I don't care. I don't care if you reach out for it or if you don't. I just want you to know you might. Tonight, on our first Hanukkah night, we're going to talk about the ancient Jews. The Jews as they were before Moses appeared and changed everything. I'm going to tell you this story my way. So what you hear is going to be different than you expect, particularly if you've heard bits and pieces of the story before, like in church or in temple, because everything you've heard before was told with an agenda, and I don't have an agenda. Even the Bible, which is the major source for most of the story, even the Bible has an agenda, lots of agendas. The Bible, at least the Old Testament, wasn't written as a tool of evangelism. You see, up until recently, you couldn't be a Jew unless you were a blood relative with another Jew. So the Tanakh, the Old Testament Jewish Bible, wasn't designed to convert you to Judaism. But nevertheless, it is crammed with political and social agendas. And this is why some passages are so confusing. Chapter 1 says, do this, and immediately after, chapter 2 says, no, do the other. Sometimes no one could decide between the two agendas, so the Bible authors just put in both. So it helps to remember that the Bible wasn't written in a single flow of words. It was assembled over time by people who wanted to make a point. If you realize that whole big chunks of the Bible were written with an agenda, and that those agenda-filled chunks got arranged later and assembled yet later into pages of what turned out to be the Bible, it changes your understanding. But like I said, I have no agenda, except I want you to love this story. And I want you to love your ancient ancestors And I want you to love your true, imperfect, glorious heritage. And I want you to love the Lord. So the story of the great miracle of Hanukkah is intimately involved with the story of the Jews. And the story of the Jews begins about 4,800 years ago with some guy and some God. And just like in our time, there were lots of guys in those days, 4,800 years ago. Not as many as in our time, maybe, just a lot. There were also a lot of gods, and this story starts with one of each. The guy was some guy named Abram. The god didn't have a name, not yet. And the gods of all other cultures had names. Nut, Osiris, Marduk, Baal, whatever. This particular god didn't have a name. And to be more precise, he did have a name, but he kept it to himself. He kept it secret for a long time. Also, this god had no form. Most gods had a form. Gods of all the other desert cultures, gods of every other culture ever, I think, had a form. Animals, mostly bulls, lions, jackals, and all the combinations. But this particular god had no form. Even at his most imposing, he had no form. He never had a form. He was everywhere, nowhere. So this is important to remember, formless. And probably most important to this story, unlike the gods of other desert cultures, this god didn't have anyone that worshipped him. This god was a lone wolf, an orphan. Nobody was making idols of this god because he didn't have a form. And nobody was calling out his name because he didn't have one. This nameless, formless god was basically astray. Now, the secret name of this god plays a big part in the story of the Jews. A few centuries later, this god finally got around to revealing his name to Moses. But since the Hebrew alphabet doesn't have any vowels, all that got recorded were the consonants. YWYH. And the Bible translators have transcribed that name as Yahweh or as the anglicized Jehovah. But in Hebrew, the consonants provide the framework of a sentence. And there's different meanings depending on the vowels you insert between the consonants. And depending on those vowels, the YHWH might get translated as I am what I am, or I will be what I will be, or I was what I was, or I might have been what I should be, or I could be what I ought to have been, or basically any other variation you can think of. But if you knew the true vowels, YHWH formed a meaningful sentence, the true secret name of the Lord. The secret name was passed from Moses, who heard it from the deity, to the first high priest, who happened to be Moses' brother Aaron, and from Aaron to the next high priest, and so on for generations. And eventually, though, the succession failed and the secret name was lost. But that secret name had power. Josephus, a Roman Jew who wrote a history of the Jews several centuries later, wrote that Jesus could do his miracles because he'd somehow stumbled across the secret name. And the secret name was so powerful that the Jews feared to say it aloud even by mistake. So instead, when they wrote about their God, they used the word Adonai or Lord. And they even feared to say that name aloud. So when they spoke about him, as I'm speaking now, they said Hashem, which means the name. This nameless, formless God, of course, was going to turn out to be the God of the Jews, the Lord of hosts, the King of the universe. But right now, there were no Jews. Right now, this God was not much more than a disembodied voice. Honestly, I'm not kidding when I say this. When you think about this God at this exact point in his history, he seems so lost, so pathetic, I actually feel a little sorry for him. And it's pretty clear also that at this time that Abram was nothing special either. He was just some guy. He could have been any guy. Abram was the great, 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 great grandson of Noah. But if you believe the story of the flood, you realize that practically everybody at this time had to be Noah's great, 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 great grandchild. After the flood, Hashem sort of mysteriously disappeared from history. He had disappeared for almost 1,000 years. Nobody heard a peep out of him. And then all of a sudden, this God once again decided to make his presence known. Now, since he had no form, and since he only seemed able to do things like make it rain a lot and so forth, I really wonder if he'd been like shouting and waving for a long time before this, but that it took a long while before anybody sort of noticed that he was trying to attract their attention. Anyway, there's no record of what Abram saw. All that's recorded is that he heard a voice. Aside from weather changes, that's actually the only real manifestation there was of this God for a long time. Just a disembodied voice. First, the disembodied voice told Abram to go one place, and Abram obeyed. Then the disembodied voice told him to go to another place, and Abram again obeyed. And then, apparently encouraged by these successful orders for Abram to go here and there, the disembodied voice followed up with a very specific, and for my money, very unexpected proposal. Hashem, the disembodied voice, offered to cut a deal, a long-term deal, a package deal. And it was quite a package. Hashem, it turned out, wanted to be worshipped. He wanted sacrifices. And he had this thing about foreskins. If Abram would cut off his foreskin, and if his descendants would cut off their foreskins, Hashem said, and if Abram and his descendants would make regular sacrifices, Hashem would give Abram lots and lots of descendants. And in time, he would give those descendants a country of their very own. So, on behalf of his unborn descendants, Abram accepted Hashem's terms. And with a quick snip, he and Hashem cut this deal. This was the covenant. Now, throughout the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, in poetry, prose, hymns, and in TV evangelism, you'll hear references to this 4,800-year-old term, the covenant. And this is what we're referring to this exact moment when Abram and Hashem cut their deal. And you probably heard about this covenant. All your life, you probably heard little bits and pieces about this huge and wonderful tapestry of a story that started with this deal. Words and images that have gone in one ear, picked up speed, and out the other. And no one's ever showed you that the pieces fit together. No one showed you how your life is connected thread by thread to that tapestry, to that astonishing moment in history. So just like when your grandmother took down that mussy old scrapbook and forced you to sit on the sofa beside her and showed you pictures of her vacant-eyed relatives that you'd heard about in conversation, people your elders spoke of that you'd never met, and how your Nana pointed out the pictures and put faces to the names, Uncle Seth, with the angry eyes, who moved to France before the Great War and was never heard from again, and Clara the suffragette, who died giving birth to your Aunt Lucy, those old faces that looked oddly familiar because you'd seen them before, in the faces of your relatives, in your own face when you looked in the mirror. Sure, you've forgotten them all by this point, but at least she showed you the web of your heritage. At least then knew that your family came from Estonia or Nairobi or County Cork. So what I'm doing now is sitting beside you like your Nana, telling you the story of your ancient ancestors and the great miracle that happened to them. This story is their story, and this story is your story. Yes, this is your story. Your story I'm telling. I don't care if you're a Muslim or a Christian or a Jew. Abram is your grandfather. Hashem is your God. Stories have to begin somewhere. The storyteller picks a point, begins to speak. And this is where I choose to begin the story of Hanukkah, with the covenant, with the deal between Abram and Hashem. That's where the great story begins. Anyway, Hashem offered the deal, and Abram signed up. Who's going to say no to Hashem? Hashem then changed Abram's name to Abraham and his wife's name from Sarai to Sarah. And you might have noticed a pattern. Names were a big deal in those days. Abraham now, and his wife were in their 70s. But Hashem promised that Sarah would get pregnant and bear a son, which she did, Isaac. The first son of Sarah was the first Jew, circumcised as promised, 8 days after his birth, which must have been quite a moment. Hon, bring me that knife. Will you, the sharp one? I got a thing I got to do with this baby. Like I said, the covenant began about 4,800 years ago, and that's a pretty long time. So let's talk about what those ancient Jews were like 4,800 years ago. You probably have some ideas about Jews, and whatever they are, whatever those ideas are, they have nothing to do with what those 4,800-year-old ancient Jews were like. So just drop everything you think you know. The Jews of that time were nothing like the Jews of today, or the Jews of Hanukkah times, or the Jews of King David's time, or Moses' time. They have nothing to do with the Jews of our own time. Those ancient Jews were just a bunch of guys with nothing in common with any other Jews, except that they could all trace their lineage back to Sarah, and they didn't have foreskins. You got to forget what you know. Those ancient Jews didn't believe a tenth of the stuff that later Jews believed. They didn't believe in heaven or hell. They didn't believe in any afterlife at all, which, like their formless, nameless God, was something very different from other religions. Almost all those other religions believed in some sort of afterlife, which was usually a dark, shadowy place underground where souls went after death. And for most cultures, the afterlife was a lot like regular life, except for being underground, and it was harder to see. So I guess you might interpret this lack of belief in an afterlife as a lack of belief in an immortal soul, which it was, which to me is pretty shocking. The ancient Jews did not believe in an immortal soul. Now, at this point, usually somebody pipes up and says, did those ancient Jews believe in angels? I guess because I mentioned dead people and souls, and a lot of people these days think that a dead person's soul becomes an angel, like in A Wonderful Life. Well, obviously, they didn't believe in that kind of angel, but did they believe in any kind? Well, no, not at this point, not those ancient Jews, at least not like we think of angels today. In fact, Jews didn't start believing in angels until about 1,500 years after Abraham. In fact, I can pretty much pinpoint the exact day when Jews began to believe in angels, and I promise I will tell you about that day later. That was quite a day. I really look forward to telling you about that day, but you need to know a lot of stuff before I can tell you about that day so you understand its significance. So, no, those ancient Jews did not believe in angels. Now, in the Bible, in the King James Version, the King James translation of the Bible, the translators used the word angel for the Hebrew word malak, which means messenger. And that word appears quite often in the Old Testament, and the translator's use of the word angel got picked up by most of the subsequent translators. So in most versions of the Bible, you'll see angels all through the Old Testament, but it's kind of a mistake. So let me tell you about Molochs. Molochs are not angels. The words of Hashem are often imparted by these Molochs. But while these Molochs seem to have some kind of ghostly presence, they never describe them. They never describe their physical attributes. They're like another vaguely embodied voice. They simply appear. There's Jacob's Ladder, which is a famous image. Jacob's Ladder, a vision that appears to Jacob, Abraham's grandson. It's a vision of Molochs walking up and down a kind of stairway that leads from heaven to earth. And later, Jacob wrestled with a Moloch who had the form of two disembodied arms. And I have no idea what to make of Molochs, except to tell you that they're not like angels, not like we imagine them today with the wings and robes and flowing hair. Angels like those, they do show up in my story later, and they show up big time, but much, much later. What the ancient Jews did believe in, though, was cherubs. Oh, good Lord, cherubs, cherubs. Cherubs are a big honking deal in the Old Testament. And cherubs are not cute little babies with pink wings. Old Testament cherubs sometimes get called guardian angels. I don't know who made up that name. Cherubs were not the hell those little sweet cartoon halo angels who sit on your shoulder and whisper in your ear to guide you away from dubious actions. Cherubs were guardians the way Sherman tanks are guardians. Cherubs were fucking monsters. Cherubs were huge, scary creatures. A lion's body and a human head. Like, think the Great Sphinx, like that, and that big. Like, it takes 8 minutes to walk around the Sphinx, and the Sphinx's forepaws are three times as tall as you are, like that. That's how big the cherubs were. And sometimes the cherubs had four faces, a lion, an ox, an eagle, and a man. And they had gigantic, multicolored wings, and they had swords, great, big, honking swords, usually flaming. When Adam and Eve got driven out of Eden, Hashem sent a cherub to do the driving. You'd flee too. Hashem may have been formless, but he made damn certain that his guarding got done by some extremely big, scary, visible creatures. And I bring this up because cherubs show up all over the place in this story. And cherub lore worked its way into Christian figures, too. The lion, ox, eagle, and man became the symbols of the evangelists, the gospel authors. And did you ever wonder why you find a painting of a lion, ox, man, and eagle in the corner walls of European cathedrals? That's to suggest that the cathedral is sort of an embodiment of a cherub, that the cathedral itself is a guardian angel. So those ancient Jews believed in cherubs. But for 1,500 years, they didn't believe in angels. And at this point, somebody always asks me, what about seraphim? Well, seraphim were snakes. Fiery, poisonous snakes. The seraphim first showed up when the Jews followed Moses out of Egypt. As the Jews were walking through the desert, a lot of Jews got bitten and killed by fiery, poisonous snakes. So the Jews didn't actually believe in seraphim, not like someone believes in angels, because seraphim were quite literally biting them on the ass. Now, 2,200 years later, Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, had a vision of the Lord of hosts on his heavenly throne surrounded by gigantic, fiery, winged snakes. In other words, dragons. He was describing dragons. And somewhere along the line, those dragons started to get depicted in paintings as winged men. So that's seraphim. But they did, these ancient Jews, they did believe in demons. They believed that demons roamed the earth. Those Jews lived in the desert, and they believed that demons lived next door. I don't know what the hell they imagined the demons to be. They don't say exactly, but I know they believed them. They believed that the main reason that Hashem sent the great flood, Noah's flood, was to get rid of some of those nasty demons. There were giants in the earth in those days. Not so much after the flood, because Hashem drowned them. But not a perfect job, because one of the demons, Azazel, a demon who lived in the desert, survived. Azazel shows up later in a major starring role. Azazel was kind of a Jewish version of Prometheus. Prometheus brought fire to man. Azazel, I love this, didn't bring fire. He brought the secret of making weapons. How to make weapons and how to make cosmetics. Yeah, Azazel brings the secret of making swords and eyeshadow from heaven as his gift to earth, brought to earth by a demon. Now, the ancient Jews, the offspring of Sarah, were more or less rudderless when it came to understanding how to worship Hashem. They had no rituals, no defined rituals, unless you consider foreskin removing a ritual, but they didn't have any specific words to say when they did it, not like a baptism or a wedding. They had no priests. They had no holy books. They had no Sabbath. They had no law. I mean, they had no law. They didn't know the Ten Commandments. Those hadn't been thought up yet. The ancient Jews were not resting on the Sabbath. No one had gotten around to asking them to do this. All they knew was that they were supposed to offer sacrifices. The sacrifices means burning something, not dedication, not intent, not giving something up, burning. Burning something until smoke comes out. You give something up to the deity, you transform it by flame into smoke. Hashem loved him his sacrifices. Hashem loved the smoke. So the ancient Jews tried to please Hashem by burning stuff. They did this as individuals, they did it as families, they did it as tribes. It was very ad hoc. Anytime, anywhere, they just build a fire wherever they happen to be and throw stuff on it. And why were they doing this? Because they wanted to stay on Hashem's good side. So pay attention. The ancient Jews, pay attention. The ancient Jews believed that Hashem would be nice to people he liked and nasty to people he didn't like. And they didn't believe in an afterlife. So they believed that Hashem was going to do whatever the hell he was going to do to them in this life, which meant that if Hashem liked you, your life was going to be a breeze. And if he didn't like you, you were fucked. And the ancient Jews saw the evidence everywhere. You just look around, do the math. There's Tommy. He's sick, poor, and sad. Why? Hashem doesn't like him. And there's Bobby, rich, healthy, and happy. Why? Hashem likes him. And about the only thing they knew for sure that Hashem liked best was sheep smoke. They believed this because they believed this one important story, one of their oldest stories. You probably heard this story, you probably even know this story, you probably know the name of the characters, Cain and his younger brother Abel, the first children of Adam and Eve. So the story goes that Cain and Abel both burned stuff for Hashem. Cain and Abel made the very first sacrifices ever. Abel was a shepherd, and he burned some sheep flesh and sheep fat. And Cain was a farmer, so he had a vegan sacrifice. Hashem liked the sheep and the sheep's smoke. The vegan smoke, not so much. And Cain got so jealous, he went and killed Abel. So Cain scored these firsts. He was the first child, the first brother, and the first murderer. And I just want to mention here, here's the story. This makes me think that this proto-myth, the basic proto-myth of the people of the book, about 10 minutes after Abel makes the sacrifice that pleases the Lord, the king of the universe, Abel, 10 minutes later, gets killed by his own brother. I don't understand why, if that's the pleasing sacrifice, that's the one you continue to make. It makes no sense to me. Anyway, from this story, the ancient Jews came to believe that Hashem most of all loved meat smoke, particularly sheep smoke, and they later came to believe they also loved the smell of fragrant resins like frankincense. But you could never tell for sure, because one guy might get rich and healthy sacrificing sheep, and another one might get sick and die poor. There's Hashem, silent, mysterious, like a high-maintenance, passive-aggressive spouse. You do something you hope he'd like, and for no particular obvious reason, he'd respond by making you sick and poor. And you try again. You try practically anything. You'd bend over backwards. You never knew how he would respond. And a couple of other things. The Jews were just a big, extended family. They were tribes. Some of them were farmers. A lot of them were shepherds. They all lived in some rough, ragged land near Gaza. They had no country to call their own. They were constantly running away from bigger and stronger tribes. They had no overarching hierarchy that ruled all the tribes, no one person to guide them, no king, and no, for sure, no army. They were easy pickings for any country that was organized that had a king and had an army and weapons. In those days, when a king wanted something done, like building a pyramid, for example, he'd just round up a bunch of Jews and make them slaves, which is how all the Jews ended up in Egypt. So I'm not going to tell you the story of the Exodus tonight. It's just too huge. But I do want to talk about some highlights because they are relevant to their story, the story of Hanukkah. So the Jews taken as slaves to Egypt, building pyramids, nasty, 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 lots of whips. And for 350 years, the Jews suffered this horrible fate, slaves in Egypt. I can't imagine a more horrible fate than being an Egyptian slave and building pyramids for 350 years. For 350 years, Hashem just disappears. Hashem, who previously shows up in dreams or says something as a disembodied voice or sends a malach or a pair of disembodied wrestling arms out of thin air or something, now, when his chosen foreskinless people are really the hell in dire need, is nowhere. He's leaving them to just pick up the check. And through those 350 years of enslavement, the Jews, bless their hearts, stayed faithful to the covenant. And here's the thing. Hashem hadn't left the building. He was backstage, preparing the next act. And it was going to be a big, honking, Las Vegas spectacular. And like all great second act spectaculars, it started quiet. The curtain goes up. Moses, a little baby secretly born to a Jew, is hidden in a basket in a swamp. Adopted by a princess, nursed by the secret mom. He grows up, kills a slave master, runs away, lives among the Jews as a shepherd, and then Moses hears the voice of Hashem from a burning bush. I just want you to know, that's a big deal. A bush that burns but is not consumed by the flame. Hashem manifesting as flame. That's a motif that's going to be repeated throughout the Old Testament, throughout the story, and this is the first time that image appears. And the Jews eventually give a name to that flame, this presence of the Lord, and they call it Shekinah. Now, there's two interesting things about Shekinah. First, Shekinah is a feminine noun. The presence of the Lord is female. And she's appearing as flame. And she shows up all the time. As it turns out, she shows up very often in the story, but this, the burning bush, this is her first appearance. So Hashem tells Moses, go to the Pharaoh, say, let my people go. And what does Moses do? He argues. Remember I asked who's going to say no to Hashem? Well, Moses. Moses. No way, he answers. And the argument goes on for some time. And it looks like Moses is going to win. And it makes me wonder, how many other guys did Hashem go to first before he settled on Moses? How many times did Hashem lose the argument and need to look someplace else? Anyway, Moses finally gives in. He gets his marching orders and he goes to Pharaoh and says, let my people go. And Pharaoh just sits there all Ubrinner. He doesn't do anything. Does anything strike you as odd? That one of the reasons I'm telling you this story instead of like writing a novel as I originally intended is that it turns out that the main character of this great story is the Lord of Hosts himself. And the Lord of Hosts is a troublesome character. It's a bitch to have Hashem as the main character. It's very troublesome. His interactions with Pharaoh via Moses are about as loopy as anything I've ever run into. If I wrote it as a story, nobody would suspend disbelief. I mean, here's Hashem, the Lord of all creation, and within a few days, he's going to bring all sorts of nasty shit down on Egypt. He's going to change the water of the Nile into blood, which is nasty enough to start, but then the whole blood thing also kills all the fish in the Nile, and they all go belly up and rot and stink up the place, and he sends down plagues of frogs and gnats and flies and pestilence and boils and hail and locusts, which completely overwhelm the whole country, and even the Jews, the chosen people, the ones on whose behalf all this nastiness is being done, get affected by these things. You think the Jews don't smell the stink of the rotten fish, so he's making the Jews suffer too? And what have the Jews done to deserve all this? Then he covers Egypt in total darkness, darkness that is seriously omnipotent. You cannot deny the power of a God who can blot out the sun. I mean, here's the thing. All this ugly stuff, which demonstrates all sorts of omnipotence, doesn't move the ball a goddamn inch. How can it be that Hashem, with the power to do all this nasty, cannot figure out how to just flip some sort of psychic switch and just change Pharaoh's mind or give him a heart attack or something? Why can't he just make the word okay come out of his lips? Well, to me, it's just bizarre and therefore very interesting. So at this point in the story, all-powerful Hashem isn't all that all-powerful. He's just a nature god, and he's strong with the locusts, weak with the people skills. In fact, this is me speaking, Hashem is a developing character. At this point in the Old Testament, he's a childlike. He's throwing tantrums. He's making a big fuss. He's wrecking things, making everybody feel bad. He's not getting his way. So the final plague. Hashem kills every firstborn child in Egypt. That's seriously harsh. Once more, not without some loopy elements, Hashem tells the Jews to mark their doorways with the blood of a lamb, and Hashem will pass over the doors that get marked with the blood of the lamb and not suffer the destroyer to come into your house and smite you. So that's what Passover is about. That's the night when death came throughout Egypt and passed over the Jews. And it's a wonderful story, and I hope you go to a Seder sometime and spend the day thinking about it. For now, I want you to just stick close to me because we're going to take some side roads because I love the destroyer. I'd really love to go down that road, but who's the destroyer? I mean, Shiva, maybe he's Shiva, but instead, let's just think about that thing about the blood of the lamb. What is this? Hashem, the Lord of creation, can't figure out on his omniscient own which houses to avoid. He has to go from door to door sniffing for lamb's blood. It's just goofy. But I want you to realize something. It's important to me. It's important to me that you understand the wise-ass way I'm telling this story. When I say Hashem's throwing a tantrum, or when I say it's goofy that Hashem needed lamb's blood, I mean no disrespect. I know it's typical for atheists or college sophomores to make fun of religious beliefs by pointing out the contradictions and absurdities, and I am not making fun of this great story. Earlier, I mentioned how Moses argued with Hashem, and I asked what kind of man would do that. I'll tell you, a man who was uncertain about the voice that spoke to him, a man who doubted, a man who doubted himself. And because he doubted himself, was unable to trust the Lord's voice. A man no different from me, for example. Maybe no different from you. So when I say that this great story is my story, I'm telling you the truth. When I talk about the absurdities or contradictions of this story, I discuss them because I love them. The absurdities and the contradictions are the story. They are why I love the story. They unfold for me the nature of the Lord and the nature of mankind. The wonderful Hasidic rabbi, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, often speaks about how Hashem gives us hints. The story is full of hints about the nature of Hashem, about the nature of people, about our relationship to the divine, about how that relationship changed again and again until the great miracle occurred. And it hints as well how it continues to change in our own time. So the Lord made me a wise ass. I have learned that I cannot overcome my wise ass nature. And if, as I truly believe, the Lord has charged me to tell this story, I think he must also want it told with my wise-ass tone. Too bad for you. How many times have I wished that I were a better storyteller, that I were a better man? But just as Hashem pulled a name out of his hat to father his chosen people, just as he chose a weak, argumentative man to lead the Jewish slaves from their Egyptian captors, so too, for some goddamn reason, he chose a wise ass to tell you this story of the great miracle. Now, this story, my story, your story, is full of hints. And if it takes a wise ass to point them out, then I guess I'm just the guy. Every year, the Jews get together to reenact the meal they ate on that terrible, frightening Passover night. Slaves in Egypt, all packed up and ready to go with their unleavened bread, because they didn't know the moment of their departure. And they needed food for the journey, and they couldn't wait around for the dough to rise. They would need to move fast when the moment came. And they did. Pharaoh had barely given permission for them to depart before he rescinded it, and he sent chariots after them to bring them back or kill them. Our ancestors were terrified, but they were brave. And I'm not going to make fun of that. By the way, here's an interesting fact or two. Passover didn't used to be a solemn holiday. It used to be a rowdy, drunken feast day. When Jerusalem was under Roman rule, which was about 3,500 years later, the Romans complained about the drunkenness on Passover. Jesus' Last Supper was probably unusual for not being a drunken party. because that's what everybody else was doing that night. Maybe that's why there was all that folderol about finding a place to hold the Last Supper, because nobody wanted to invite 13 grown men over to go all frat house for Passover. That long, solemn Seder that Jews celebrate today, that didn't get started until around 200 CE. The Haggadah, the Passover ceremony that starts with some kid asking what makes this night different from all other nights, that didn't show up until the 11th century. Part of the Haggadah that often gets ignored, I'm sorry to say, because it sounds like a lot of fun, is that the Seder meal is supposed to be eaten while reclining, not seated like slaves, not on one's feet like the ancient Jews, trembling as the destroyer passed through the town, but reclining, the way rich nobles ate their meals, in ease. I like to think about that. I like to think about the Last Supper taking place around a low table, with Jesus and the disciples stretched out on couches. So the way Jews currently celebrate the Seder is pretty old, but it's not their ancient way. It's not a tradition handed down from Jew to Jew from Moses' time. As traditions go, it's not even as old as Hanukkah. In fact, Jews were lighting the lights of Hanukkah for more than 1,000 years before they started having Haggadahs at Passover. Judaism has reinvented itself a score of times. A lot of stuff that Jews talk about as if they were ancient traditions didn't really get started until the Middle Ages, like bar mitzvahs, for example, which only got started around the 14th century in Spain. Even Jewish weddings are kind of new, at least the kind of solemn rites we know about today. Before the 5th century, they were fairly ribald. Wine parties that lasted for days. Remember Jesus turning water into wine? That was like day 3 of a 4-day wedding party. They'd run out of wine for Pete's sake, and still no one was going home. That should give you some idea about what Jewish weddings were like. Finally, in the 5th century, some rabbi, introduced the concept of actually exchanging vows. That was a new idea. He also suggested not drinking so much. And he introduced the ritual of breaking the wine glass. That rabbi, I suppose, thinking that if you reduce the amount of stemware, you might also reduce the wine consumption. And another thing, you might think I'm tossing in these facts like some sort of trivia. I'm not. This story has no trivia. I promise you, it's all part of the story. This story didn't end in 165 BCE. It's still going on today. For one thing, I'm telling you about seders and weddings and bar mitzvahs to remind you of the importance, the relative importance, of the Hanukkah celebration, which has been maintained continuously for over 2,000 years. That's an indication of the importance of Google's least important Jewish holiday. Anyway, back to Egypt. The destroyer killed all those Egyptian babies, and Yul Brynner lets all the Egyptian slaves go, and all it took was 10 horrific plagues. Then Moses led the Jews away, parted the Red Sea, drowned the Pharaoh's chariots, and walked several 100,000 men, women, and children into the merciless Sinai desert, which is where we'll leave them until tomorrow. Right now, it's time for latkes.